I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s,
she looked like a million bucks,
scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, this is Paris Hilton. Trapped in Treatment is back, and this season we're taking on WASP, the Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs and Schools.
They held us in dog cages. They starved us. They beat us.
He was trying to brand us. So we were going to become the McDonald's of kid treatment.
Join my host as they unravel the story of the largest and most shocking organization in the history of the troubled teen industry. Listen to Season 2 of Trapped in Treatment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late-night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, dude.
The 90s called...
with Christine Taylor and David Lasher.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Hey Dude, the 90s Crawled podcast. I am one of your hosts, David.
Hi, David. I'm your other host, Christine.
I know who you are.
I know who you are.
What's up?
It's good to see you.
You too, always.
I feel like our 90s, totally 90s trivia pop culture questions was a hit because we had a lot of people chiming in with the answers. Do you even remember the question from last week?
Yes, because I looked on our Instagram page and I was like, oh my God, this
people loved it. And so I'm going to repeat the question again, but anybody who's listening, in Saved by the Bell, what were Zach and Kelly dressed up as the night before they broke up? Unanimously, everybody said Romeo and Juliet, which is the correct answer. Most people were mad at me for even giving multiple choice. Because if you're a huge Saved by the Bell fan, you would know that. You wouldn't need the multiple choice. And then I went through because I just figured I'd give you a trivia question. We'll do it again. We'll give another trivia.
This time I won't.
This time I won't give multiple choice. And let's see how that goes.
Yeah, make it a little more challenging.
All right, here we go. I didn't even know this show was a 90s show. I thought this was like an 80s show, but maybe it was. I guess it was a 90s show. Question, name the fictional town where Mighty Morphin Power Rangers is set. Would you know that? Fictional town.
No, that's not a show I watched.
We were probably a little older, right? It was probably like
Right. Yeah.
This might be for the younger folk. Because I don't think, we were in the 90s, we were in our 20s, so we weren't really watching Power Rangers.
I was aware of it. I know the Power Rangers were a huge brand.
The Power Rangers were huge. That's why I feel like, I felt like maybe it was more, maybe it's late 80s into 90s. But I will not give a multiple choice, and let's see if people know
the fictional town that the Power Rangers were from.
That it was set in, that the show was set in.
Okay.
And I'll answer that next week.
All right. Yeah. Leave comments on our Instagram. And then speaking of 90s, do you want to officially announce this exciting thing?
I think it's been officially announced that we are going to 90s Con together. Woohoo!
So excited. Yeah, it was nice. That's for entertainment. And Us Weekly did a really nice article yesterday on we'll be there. In Hartford, Connecticut, right?
Hartford, Connecticut.
What a random place for this gigantic
I think they must have, they must house a giant convention center there is going to be my guess. They have to find cities that have these big places, right?
How far is it from New York City? Do you know? Hartford?
I think it's a few hours.
Oh, okay. So we're going to stay in Hartford.
Yes. I guess. Yes. I think we're staying at a hotel near the venue. But our co-star Kelly Brown is confirmed, and our co-star Josh Tygel, who I still think of as a young boy who's not, because if you saw the picture, he's a beard. Which he's a grown man.
He's a private investigator who we need to hire him to find Joe Torres.
This is what we'll talk to him about. Yes. He is confirmed. I believe other people are figuring out if they can do it. I'm not sure. I think Dave Brisbane, we're figuring out if he can do it. But either way, the four of us will be there that weekend for a little. It's the 35th. Reunion. It's not like it's, I know, I don't think it's meant to be just like a marker, but it's 35 years since.
And never done a convention, right? We've never shown up. Me, you, Kelly,
no.
Josh. We've never done this.
I've never even been asked to do a convention before for anything 90s, for anything.
But this 90s con is a big thing. I've been watching it from the sidelines.
Conventions in general are becoming bigger. Comic-Con, and it's like there's all kinds of. It's a great way for us to get to say hi to fans and for us to see each other. And maybe we'll even try to do a podcast when we're there. That would be good.
Oh, let's talk to iHeart about that. Because there'll be, my whole Sabrina cast is going to be there.
Right.
I read in the article, they're like, you're going to go back and forth.
That was the first time you read that you'll be going from booth to booth. Yeah, I didn't know.
They don't, whatever.
David will be bebopping around.
You want to tell about our great guest?
We have an incredible guest today who is genuinely, and I know we say we have a lot of friends who come on, and we do, but this is truly like one of my nearest and dearest friends in the world who got his start in the 90s and has done if you don't know his name, Dan Bukatinski, you have seen him in something or you have watched something that he has written, because he has been in and written for most of the, like, some of the biggest shows of the 90s and the 2000s. So let's welcome him in and talk to my friend Dan Bukatinski.
Hi.
There he is.
How are you?
You look great.
Thank you.
Dan, this is David. David, this is Dan. David, one of my oldest friends in the world. Dan, one of my bestest friends in the world.
Yep.
My bestie.
Great to meet you. Thanks for being here, man.
It's a pleasure to meet you. I've heard a lot about you, and I'm a fan of your of this and all of it. Whether I was a fan of the 90s or not is a different question.
Oh, really?
But it was so funny when I asked you and you said, you're like, most of my work was really after the 90s, but listen, we were all getting started at that time. Those are the stories that fascinate us so much, of like where you were at, what you were doing, what was in the ether for you. So you don't have to, and we'll get to all of the good work too. We'll get to all of the good stuff.
We don't have to get to the good stuff. I think it's fascinating. Once you asked me, I went back. I really couldn't remember. I blacked out the entire decade. So, because it really.
So did we. So did I.
You say that too, David. I know.
Most of our guests say, who did I ask the other day? Daisy Fuentes responded to me. Yeah, I'll come on, but I don't remember anything.
Well, I moved to Los Angeles in 1991. So like the first 10 years of trying to even get settled in this city and trying to figure out what the hell to do were the 90s for me. And it's so funny because I think back to that time and it's like, I was so dumb.
We were all transplanting ourselves into that city right then, because 90, yeah. David, 91 was for us too, right?
Yep, exactly. 90, yep.
All right. So, Dan.
I auditioned for Friends.
See?
Oh, wow.
It's like
you were one of the lucky ones because you actually got an audition. I didn't even get an audition for Friends.
Which role? I remember the sides for Chandler, and I was like, okay. You know, working on the sides for Chandler and feeling like, I'm not going to get this. And I was right. I didn't get it.
You're not still waiting to hear?
I think there's a pin in me.
You might still get it.
Here's
the thing. I know probably... I know so much about your life, but we also had Ben on. He was one of our first guests, and he told a couple of stories I had never heard before, which was so much fun, like some fun New York audition stories back in the day that I'd never heard. I heard the classics, but I know a little bit of your background, and also because you just came and you had a big high school reunion. Dan grew up in Westchester, New York, and he went to his reunion and stayed with us for the weekend.
I'm from Scars Hill.
Oh, I'm from Chappaqua.
Oh, wow.
And I don't say which reunion it was. It was like my 70th. But but I hadn't been to one reunion, not one college reunion, not one high school reunion, not 5, 10, none of them.
Right.
And I don't know what got into me. I had to come to New York anyway for this other thing. And I just thought, oh, my God, if Christine. By the way, you were a big draw. Like the fact that you were going to be even in town. I was like, if I can at least land at Christine's and be able to like decompress from seeing all these people who were horrible to me in high school.
Right.
But very, very nice at the reunion, I'm sure.
Very nice at the reunion. They were like, hey, what's up, buddy? A lot of people were like, you still acting?
Oh, no.
Oh, my God. Stop. You have to recite your resume.
I was like, no, I gave it up.
Wait, can I ask, how did you two meet?
We met because I wrote a pilot. I'm trying to think if that was actually the first time we ever met, but it was. I was a fan, but I wrote a pilot in 2000, whatever it was. Then CBS picked it up, and it was about three couples who commute from New York to basically to Chappaqua. It's a story I've been trying to make for a million years, and believe it or not, I'm rebooting it. But
reverse commute.
It's the commute, right? And the show is called Commuters. And we offered a role to Christine, and she came. I'll never forget. You came into our office. Lisa Kudrow and I were producing partners for 15 years, and our offices were at Warner Brothers. And it was one of the rainy days in LA, and you had this gorgeous trench coat, and you came into the office, and I was so starstruck. And you sat down, and we started gabbing from the second we met to the present.
It's true.
That's awesome.
It never stopped. And what I was hiding under that trench coat was a child that I was going to have in the summer.
Yeah.
But I didn't want anyone to know that I was pregnant because I wasn't really showing. And it was Quinn. And so this was, it was 2000. And was it the fall of 2004?
We shot it in the March of 2005.
That's right.
We were adopting, my husband and I were adopting a baby at the exact same time. And so we were pregnant and we had the baby while we were shooting Commuters. So I remember bringing the baby to set, not a great idea. And David Arquette, like bringing the baby to his trailer. And I was like, is this sanitary?
David Arquette and I played husband and wife. It was like three different couples and what the drama sort of underneath.
Your secret at the end of the pilot was that you were pregnant.
Right. That's right.
Oh, my God. That's perfect.
It was good.
Yeah, it was such a good pilot, and it was so much fun.
And we had such a good time.
We did. And you did. I feel like when we were shooting, because I ended up having him in July.
Yeah.
So 4 months after we shot. So I do remember starting to show a little bit, but I wasn't showing too much when we met. And I didn't want the network to know. When they were offering it to me, because I wanted the job so badly, so I was like, I will not disclose this.
Well, that's how we met, and then we became instant buddies, and then Ben and Christine and my husband and I would like have these dinners in New York, and we just kept it going for however many years it's been, almost 20.
Dan's husband is Don Roos, who is a writer, director, has done incredible films that you know that.
Talk about the 90s. He wrote Single White Female. He wrote this movie called Love Field. And then he wrote this movie called The Opposite of Sex, which we shot in 1997. And it was the beginnings of my relationship with Kudrow. And then that sort of, we started a company and then we made all these other things, you know, in the next decade. But
you and Don were together already when you did the movie together? Because you have a role in Opposite of Sex. So you guys were already.
We met in 92.
Okay.
So I was only coming out to L.A. In 1991, I came out to L.A. with a sketch show that I had written, a two-person sketch show that I was performing in New York at the Duplex at all these clubs. And we had a shot of doing the show in L.A. And I was going to come out for a one-year experiment and then go back to New York. I did not want to stay in Los Angeles. I want to make that perfectly clear. I had no intention of staying in Los Angeles. And I met Don a year later, and then I didn't think that was going to pan out at all. We met and he was nice, but he was older than me and more established. And I was working in the box office of a theater in Beverly Hills on Cannon Drive. And it was 1991 and I was making $8 an hour. And I was just like all about making my sketch show and getting an HBO special. And I was just very, very driven. And I just didn't think I had time for any of that. And I wound up staying in Los Angeles and with him for 31 years.
Dude, that's a good look back. That's why you're here, man.
End of podcast.
End of podcast.
That's my 90s.
And now I'm in my 90s. And it feels good. It feels good. I feel like I've had all the right work done.
But okay, see, that's a story I didn't know. I didn't realize that you had come to LA with a sketch show. So you graduated from Vassar. Did you study drama?
I did, but I was an American studies major. I was like an independent major. And ironically, I put together this thesis I had to write about the American family and how it's portrayed in comedies in television. And my whole writing career from 2000 to the present has in one way or another been all about writing comedies about the American family. So like the fact that when I was 20, I wanted to write this sort of historical look back at what made a comedy for why television was the right medium for portraying the American family and how it's changed over the years. And I, ironically, that's what I wound up writing a million times. It's weird. Wait,
which TV families did you write about? Do you remember?
I wrote about I Love Lucy. I wrote about, I think Father Knows Best or Leave It to Beaver, one of those two. And then I wrote about the Brady Bunch and All in the Family. I picked one from every decade.
I mean, to go from like, you know,
the Cosby Show.
I Love Lucy to All in the Family in those 20 years. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, just what the politics of what it looked like to be in a marriage in the 50s, what it looked like to be in a marriage in the 60s, and then 70s and 80s, and then it was in the 80s that I turned it in, so I couldn't really talk about.
By the way, that would be a great little docuseries.
Oh, yeah.
Just throwing it out there.
David plants lots of seeds in this podcast. So, and he always puts it out there for the public to steal. He doesn't save them.
No. David gets points in everything that he gets pitched.
No, I want to read your thesis, but I would watch
it. Terrible. I found it in a box recently, and I was like, I think I used the word perspectives about 75 times. In 80 pages. So do the math. 75 times in 80 pages.
And today you just tell your ChatGPT, replace perspective.
With anything else.
Yeah.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s.
She looked like a million bucks.
With zero qualifications.
She had a Harvard plaque.
Tricks her way past a wall of lawyers and agents.
She's got all of these Maseratis and Bentleys all in the driveway.
Is it like a mansion?
Yes, it's a mansion that this queen of the con uses to scam some of the biggest names in professional sports out of untold fortunes.
About $6 million.
Approximately $11 million.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
Employing whatever means necessary to bleed her victims dry.
She would probably have sex with one of her clients.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, this is Paris Hilton. Trapped in Treatment is back, and this season we're taking on WASP.
They held us in dog cages. They starved us. They beat us. They burned us and subject us to really horrible, cruel and unusual punishment.
After my personal experience at Provo Canyon School, I was shocked to learn that a man named Robert Litchfield, a man who got his start at the school that I went to, would go on to create a multi-million dollar empire.
He was trying to brand us, so we were going to become the McDonald's in treatment.
The Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs and Schools.
They prey on, you know, a parent's really natural and beautiful love for their children in a really, really, unfortunately, effective way.
At this time in my life now, if someone presented this program to me, and not just because I've already experienced it, sham, scam, beware.
Listen to Season 2 of Trapped in Treatment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite in powerful conversations. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. I want you all to join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. In every episode, we gather a seasoned elder.
But even with a child, there's no such thing as the wrong thing if you love them.
Myself, as the middle generation, I don't feel like I have to get married at this big age in life, but it is a desire I have and something that I've navigated in dating. And a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations.
I'm very jealous of your generation that didn't have to deal with Instagram and Tinder.
This is Across Generations, where Black women's voices unite, and together, you know how we do, we create magic. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so Vassar, you graduate, and that was when you were crafting this.
I graduated. God, so embarrassing. I graduated with and I went to Europe with my friends, and then I came back and I moved to New York to a basement apartment, like Laverne and Shirley.
Right.
Old reference. might have still been playing in the 90s, so there.
And our listeners know Laverne and Shirley.
This tiny apartment, it was $500 a month, that was where I could see everyone's feet. I hated it. I felt like a rodent in a cage. And I lived there while I took dance classes and singing classes and acting classes. And I was going to be on Broadway. I was going to be in a Broadway show. That was all I had my sights set on. And I did really crazy, stupid things that are really embarrassing. Like
musical? You wanted to be in a musical too?
I wanted to be in anything. I wanted to be in a musical or a play, but I was relentless. I was relentless. I would go to all the agencies because they were all within five blocks. Remember in New York, there was like one building where nine agents had offices. And then there was another building where five agents had offices. And once a month, I would slide my picture and resume under the door with not in an envelope with a letter, but face up. Because someone had said, there's no way they can't see your face if you throw that picture. I mean, and more than once, somebody opened the door while I was on my hands and knees sliding my picture and someone stepped on my face. Like, this is not humiliating.
It's certainly not glamorous.
But it's not unique. I'll tell you this. A lot of our guests will go back and tell stories of what they had to do. And it's fascinating.
I was so shamelessly, like, I just wanted it so badly. And I would do, and then I got a little job and I got another little job and they were like really, really little jobs. And then I got my SAG card doing a Haagen-Dazs industrial. And then I can't believe I'm saying this out loud. Oh God. And then I made flyers with my picture on them that said, there's more to being an actor than just calling yourself one. And then I wrote Dan Bukatinski, and then I bullet pointed the five pathetic jobs I had just gotten that were like ridiculous. Okay. They were like, you know, along the lines of just stood outside Rockefeller Center handing out flyers for the Today Show, you know, stuff like that. But I would just send these to the agencies like, you know what? There's more to being an actor than just calling yourself one. And I am more than just calling myself one, although I totally was. So I was shameless and pathetic. But then I went to the Groundlings and I took some classes and I started writing sketches. And then I wrote this two-person show called Fear of Crashing. And we performed it in a bunch of clubs in New York and got some good reviews and then had this chance to perform it in LA. And I milked that show for a really long time.
And is that how you met Lisa? Was Lisa through the comedy world?
No.
Because it wasn't at Vassar either, right?
We didn't meet at Vassar. I had done a play at Vassar that she remembers coming to see, but she and I were never friends and we never crossed paths. We didn't cross paths until Don, my husband, cast her in The Opposite of Sex with Christina Ricci. And Lisa came on set and she was like, we went to Vassar. And I said, I know. And then we became friends while he was shooting that movie in 1997. And from that point on, she and her husband and Don and I would get together. And then Don and I would go on Friday nights to the tapings of the Friends episodes. And we would just hang out in her dressing room and play dominoes and eat the food. So to this day, yeah. I've missed about four seasons of episodes because I was upstairs and I was playing dominoes.
You were like primo access. I mean, I remember going to as well. Like, I mean, you know, it was just, that was the hang, which we talk about a lot on the podcast is with actors and our peers of the just the hanging out. Like even your relationship with Lisa, how that blossomed just on the set of hanging out while, you know, you're waiting for them to set. Law,
just for our listeners, on Friday nights, the Friends taping was the best hang in LA.
Yeah.
Right. It was the place to be. And, you know, ER was shooting there. I think I did a bunch of Veronica's Closet. And if you were anywhere near there, it was so much fun.
It was
auditioning on that lot was always like you could not see some star that was shooting a series there. It was that's Anthony Edwards. And, you know, you would just see them kind of wandering through.
Yeah.
It was pretty great. And they had so much, they had so much clout at that point. It was like, you know, that was season 6, 7, 8, 9. It was like it was the second half and they had tons of clout and tons of power. And they had Warner Brothers build them a hangout. I don't know if you remember this, but behind stage 25, which was the Friends stage, they built this area that they wanted just for them that nobody else could go into. And it had refrigerators and tables and couches. It was a hangout. They made Warner Brothers build it and they built it and they never stepped foot in it.
Stop.
Oh my God. I remember George Clooney had a basketball court put in outside the ER stage.
But did he play? He played.
He did. Yes.
These guys just wanted to know that they had a place to hang, but didn't hang there.
Listen, Yeah, go ahead, Chris.
No, I was just going to ask what year did you do Your Friends? And was that, did you have to audition?
Okay, so just a real quick skip. So yeah. Don did The Opposite of Sex. And then I wrote a movie that was very loosely based on some sketches from that original Fear of Crashing show. I turned the main character from a straight guy to a gay guy, and I turned it into this romantic comedy called All Over the Guy, which I shot for $500,000 in 1999. So literally a year after I met Lisa, she did a cameo in it. Christina Ricci did a cameo in it. Like, I asked a million favors, and we sold the movie, and it came out in theaters. And as a result of that, Lisa said to me, they want to offer me a pod deal. At the time, they called these vanity deals. Like, any star of a show could get a production entity on the Warner Brothers lot with an assistant and a budget and a golf cart. And they didn't really expect much from it, but it was like a way of keeping their casts in the Warner Brothers family.
Yeah. Yes.
And they would set, and Lisa was setting up, having meetings with every executive and every agent who wanted to leave agencies and become a development executive. And Lisa said to me, I don't want to partner with an agent. I don't want to partner with a development executive. I want to partner with another actor, writer who could be creative. And everyone said, who's this guy? Do not partner up with just some guy. And she was like, no, he just made a movie, and that's who I want to partner up with. So we started a company, and she was still shooting Friends. So all of our conference calls would happen from her dressing room, and we would have meetings at our office, which was just a few buildings over.
You could use the golf cart.
Golf cart was I was in that thing.
Major golf cart envy. That is the status symbol of our time.
Again, they didn't even, the cast didn't even know they had them. Here's the other thing. There was a storage closet somewhere on the Warner Brothers lot where there were six golf carts, one for each of the cast members of Friends, and none of them knew they had them. So I uncovered Lisa's, and I put our logo of our company, Natch, because I'm obsessed with swag and logos and marketing bullshit. And I put our logo on the golf cart, and I zipped around that lot for 3 years.
That is so much fun.
But I was always at the table reads, and my husband and I had become friends with David Crane, who had created Friends. And so they saw me there a lot. And there was an episode where they were like, Dan, do you want to play the waiter in Lisa's birthday episode? And I said, yeah, great. Does he come back? Was always, you know, could it be two episodes?
If you're really good.
So it was, yeah, they offered it to me because I had sort of been around, and it was a lot of fun. And Schwimmer,
you were part of the family. I was part of the family by that point.
And yes. Schwimmer, I didn't really know the other cast members though. Like I was pretty much, I don't remember really having a relationship with any of the others that much. They all said hi to me and hugs and all that stuff, but we weren't friends.
Well, and also by then they were all so stratospheric that they were all off. Like even when I did my episode, Matt LeBlanc was off shooting Lost in Space in England, in London. And so he wasn't there all week. It was his stand-in. And then the tape day, he was there. That was his contract, that he would come in to shoot.
What
season was it? It was season five or something.
I know,
like,
but
that.
Still, not to have
four or
any,
five.
I mean, to no, not he have would. The camera or he, clock or,
yeah, he. You know, there was like an early rehearsal in the day that he could just kind of. But by that point, it was so second nature to them.
Yeah.
And I just think so many of they were all sort of off in doing so many other things too. So totally. It was sort of a different time at that point.
It was, and we had just become. It was sort of normal for me to come in and have a meeting with Lisa up in her dress while they were rehearsing, and it was an exciting time to be starting a company, and we made a bunch of pilots, and The Commuters was part of a Warner Brothers deal, a part of our deal. And I made another pilot that Lisa produced with me, and she and I produced a handful of pilots. We did one with Janine Garofalo the same year we shot Commuters. It was like 2004.
Okay.
Yeah, and actually I did Friends in 2004. All this stuff now is, we started the company in 2003. All this stuff is post-90s, but
that's okay.
I'm so sorry. I'm ruining everything.
You are this you're going to kill our podcast.
You gave us some great 90s stories. Now we can move forward.
I want to tell you one thing, though. I just remember when I first came to L.A., like maybe within 3 or 4 years, I don't know how I did it, but I started this robust voiceover career. And I worked for about 9 years doing trailers and commercials. It kept me alive because I wasn't getting any other work, for sure. And one of the trailers I did was for Dude, Where's My Car?
Yeah, of course.
Dude, Where's My Car? So, I mean, that's the best 90s story ever.
And that's the best job in the world, right? Voice-over acting? Oh my God.
We have so many people come on and say that was their bread and butter. That's the best job in the world. And like David and I cannot get a voiceover job to save our lives. The only entry in is knowing somebody now. No, I know,
but I can't get it. I worked all the time. It was like a great way to keep myself alive while I was trying to do other things. I cannot get arrested as a voiceover actor today. Cannot.
And by the way, I mean, and I have to pick and choose now, but I'll get sent things to read for and talk about, and you're doing this in the privacy of your own home, but if anyone could have a camera of me in where they say, go into your closet, put a coat over your head, you're trying to put a flashlight on your sides and you're only reading the lines that you're supposed to read. You don't have someone reading with you. So you're just reading like one off.
It's crazy. It's just crazy.
And that is where it really start. I start to spiral downward and I'm like, what am I doing? Drenched in sweat in the closet with the thing over the coat. And I was like, maybe if I just don't do it with the coat over my head, I won't sweat as much.
Or maybe if I just don't do it. That's what I always come to. I'm like, what happens if I don't do this? Oh, right.
Then you definitely won't get it.
I won't get it because I'm not going to anyway. But the dignity comes back.
The dignity. Oh, don't talk to actors about dignity.
Don't talk about dignity.
Don't. I know. Don't.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, this is Paris Hilton. Trapped in Treatment is back, and this season we're taking on WASP.
They held us in dog cages. They starved us. They beat us. They burned us and subject us to really horrible, cruel and unusual punishment.
After my personal experience at Provo Canyon School, I was shocked to learn that a man named Robert Litchfield, a man who got his start at the school that I went to, would go on to create a multi-million dollar empire.
He was trying to brand us, so we were going to become the McDonald's of kid treatment.
The Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs in Schools.
They prey on, you know, a parent's really natural and beautiful love for their children in a really, really, unfortunately, effective way.
At this time in my life now, if someone presented this program to me, and not just because I've already experienced it, sham, scam, beware.
Listen to Season 2 of Trapped in Treatment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s.
She looked like $1 million.
With zero qualifications.
She had a Harvard plaque.
tricks her way past a wall of lawyers and agents.
She's got all of these Maseratis and Bentleys all in the driveway.
Is it like a mansion?
Yes, it's a mansion.
That this queen of the con uses to scam some of the biggest names in professional sports out of untold fortunes.
About $6 million?
Approximately $11 million.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
Employing whatever means necessary to bleed her victims dry.
She would probably have sex with one of her clients.
Hide your money in your old Richmond, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite in powerful conversations. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. I want you all to join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. In every episode, we gather a seasoned elder.
But even with a child, there's no such thing as the wrong thing if you love them.
Myself, as the middle generation, I don't feel like I have to get married at this big age in life, but it is a desire I have and something that I've navigated in dating. And a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations.
I'm very jealous of your generation that didn't have to deal with Instagram and Tinder.
This is Across Generations, where Black women's voices unite, and together, you know how we do, we create magic. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Can we talk about web therapy? Are we up to that point yet or no?
Yes, web therapy and the comeback. I really want to talk about the comeback too, because
the comeback was predated web therapy.
Okay, so go comeback.
Yes. Let's
go.
The comeback was the year, I mean, this was all happening at the same time. It was like the year after we started our company, the comeback happened. It was a combination of things. Lisa was having these lunches with Michael Patrick King to try to collaborate on a project.
And this was going to be her first series post Friends, right?
Like, so just after Friends. I mean,
and just for our listeners, Michael Patrick King wrote Sex and the City, correct?
Yeah, he ran Sex and the City. Like, yes. Darren Star created it, but then Michael ran it for the rest.
So that's a powerful duo right there.
Mm-hmm. Powerful duo. And HBO had a deal with Michael Patrick King, so they were going to try to come up with something for Lisa to do at HBO. And around that time, I'll never forget it, we were at our offices at Warner Brothers, and Lisa and I had been watching this reality show. And by the way, reality was a completely different world at that time. It was just starting out. Survivor was new. Amazing mm-hmm. Race was new. And this wild show that followed Anna Nicole Smith. Do you guys remember that?
Oh, yes.
I remember it.
It was
so well.
On E! And it was like cameras in her bedroom and cameras on the road with her. And just, let's just follow Anna Nicole Smith and just see what we get, was sort of the premise of it. And it was riveting. And yes. Lisa, at the Groundlings, years earlier, when she was just getting started, she was in the Groundlings, and she played this character that she called panel character, like talk show character. And it was a character of an actress on The Tonight Show. And it was basically Valerie Cherish, her character from The Comeback. And she was imagining, Lisa had this idea, like, imagine if cameras were following, like Anna Nicole Smith, but they were following this totally self-obsessed actress who had a hit in the 80s. And she sort of talked about that with Michael. And at the end of like a 3-hour lunch, they had cooked up this notion that they would do a show that was the raw footage of a reality show about Valerie Cherish, a woman who had a hit in the 80s, but was now about to make her comeback. And
genius. Beyond brilliant.
We almost called it raw footage. We decided on the comeback, but it was going to be called raw footage. In fact, the production company we created to make the comeback was called Raw Footage Productions. We soon realized that we couldn't just air raw footage because we really wanted to. You absolutely had to edit it, but it still played like the outtakes in a way of just cameras rolling all the time and seeing the cameras in frame and all that stuff that was so fun to do. And, Michael and Lisa and I went to HBO to pitch the show. Carolyn Strauss was the head then and had no idea what we were talking about. At least we were improvising, like in the room at that table. She was
doing
like
Valerie. She was doing Valerie. Her
and Carolyn was like, guys, you're just going to have to shoot it. I don't really know.
Stop the pitch right now. You can go shoot.
And that's a perfect example of like when you walk in there with Lisa and Friends was over and I was at the height of her career, yes, or at least at that time so far. And Michael was at the top of his game.
Yes.
HBO is going to take us, you know, is going to take a flyer on something like that because it's a good bet.
Yes.
And we got to make a bunch of episodes and it was sort of became, it didn't ever get a huge following, but it got a cult following.
Yeah.
And so a comeback happened and we were shooting it right at the same time that I was shooting The Commuters and that Janine Garofalo pilot, like we had, and we were having a baby. 2005 almost blew my brain.
Wow.
It was just too much.
And Dan, were you always going to play that character or was that sort of written? Did that just evolve?
It evolved, believe it or not. You know,
So you were her publicist, right?
Yeah.
It's but so that, good. You that, really? That,
I think, I can't really explain it. It was like a weird dynamic. When we first started doing the comeback, Lisa and Michael were partners in having created it, but Lisa and I were partners as producers. And it was it was hard to define roles at that time and collaborations. And I was in the writer's room some of the time, and I was also off doing other things. But once Michael came up with this idea of this publicist that Valerie's got to get a gay, and she and so she's got to hire, you know, all the good actresses have a gay, and she needs a publicist, and she's got to get a gay, and so she meets this publicist who is like on his way out of PMK. You know, the thing about the comeback is like no matter what, she was always sort of dealing with the loser. But she put a big spin on it, you know, the guy who had just left a really good job and the hair and makeup person who had left a really good job. They were all right. All her people.
The slight sort of like the lovable misfits, the rejects. All coming together.
The island of misfit toys.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And she herself was one, but would never acknowledge that about herself. She just, that's what I always admired Valerie as a character. People found her so cringy, but I found her like, oh my God, she always lands on her feet. She thinks she's amazing. She knows how to spin failure into, let's just get back up on our feet. Like I found her incredibly inspiring character.
I want to live that way.
Me too.
Yes, everybody. Those characters are fascinating.
They're fascinating. They're like, look at my People's Choice Award. And you're not thinking like, oh my God, you have a People's Choice Award. Like good for you. And it's in her it wall and all of her, you know.
The characters like that are delusional, right? I mean, there's something wrong with them. Which makes them more that all the more interesting.
Yes, either that or they're happier than any of us.
Right? They found the secret sauce. I mean, being delusional,
you kind of need to be, I think. But it's anyway, the comeback ride was really scary because nobody really knew what we were doing, and then we aired, and you know that, and then after the comeback we got nominated for all these Emmys, and then we were canceled. It was devastating. It was September. It was my birthday, September 22nd of 2005. I was on a plane to New York because my father had just been diagnosed, and it was a terrible time. And on the airplane before taking off, Lisa called me to tell me that we didn't get a pickup, and I was like, oh my God, it could be. And this is our business. It can be so good, and it can be so punishing. And you just have to be able to ride that wave. That was a really tough one to swallow for a very long time, because we loved it and people loved it. And the critics sort of found it fascinating and interesting. And HBO had just aired too many shows about the business at the exact same time. Clooney had that one that was about behind the scenes on a movie, and Extras had just been aired, all the same network, all on HBO.
And Entourage, I know, Carolyn.
Yeah, there was like four shows that were navel gazing about the business, and they just looked at them all as too much, and so they
inside. We need to broaden our horizons. But then, what happened with season two? Was that another network?
9 years later.
Yeah,
9 years later. I, you know, 9 years later, it was time. There was an idea on the table, and I had had a conversation with somebody at HBO that was like, would you ever
think about this?
And I said, and if you would, then you need to pick up the phone and call my partners, and because you broke up with us, so we're not going to ask you for another date. I literally said, if you got to ask us for another date. And so they did, and we went in and pitched another season, and it was absolutely one of the most satisfying things to create and to shoot. And it was a much darker season, and Seth Rogen was in it and played this character, and like exploring who Valerie had become in the 9 years since she was on the air before. And now it's been 9 years since that second season.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, this is Paris Hilton. Trapped in Treatment is back, and this season we're taking on WASP.
They held us in dog cages. They starved us. They beat us. They burned us and subject us to really horrible, cruel and unusual punishment.
After my personal experience at Provo Canyon School, I was shocked to learn that a man named Robert Litchfield, a man who got his start at the school that I went to, would go on to create a multi-million dollar empire.
He was trying to brand us, so we were going to become the McDonald's of kid treatment.
The Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs and Schools.
They prey on, a parent's really natural and beautiful love for their children in a really, really, unfortunately, effective way.
At this time in my life now, if someone presented this program to me, and not just because I've already experienced it, sham, scam, beware.
Listen to season 2 of Trapped in Treatment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s,
she looked like a million bucks,
with zero qualifications,
she had a Harvard plaque,
tricks her way past a wall of lawyers and agents.
She's got all of these Maseratis and Bentleys all in the driveway.
Is it like a mansion?
Yes, it's a mansion that this queen of the con uses to scam some of the biggest names in professional sports out of untold fortunes.
About $6 million.
Approximately $11 million.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
Employing whatever means necessary to bleed her victims dry.
She would probably have sex with one of her clients.
Hide your money in your old Richmond, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top
of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been involved in so many successful shows. Well, go ahead, David. Let's talk about Web Therapy. We need to talk about Scandal. We need to talk about who do you think you are. We need to talk about, like, you
Web Therapy makes me think of you and Lisa as sort of pioneers, because to the way you distributed the show, it was before Netflix, right?
Well, no, Netflix was in the little red envelopes.
Right. It was before the streaming Netflix that we all know. But explain how you guys released that show, which was ahead of its time.
It really, and again, you don't know that you're ahead of your time until time goes back. So at the time, we were, you know, we were being told by our agents, you know, would you guys consider doing a web series? And Lisa kept being asked that. And she was like, I don't want to do a web series. I don't see the point in taking a pilot that someone wrote and cutting it into three pieces and then airing it as small little pieces. The only thing I can imagine doing really, and I remember when she said this, she's like, if we did something for the web, it should be designed for the web. It should be like something that exists only on the web. Like, how stupid would it be if someone got their therapy in 3-minute bites in between lunch breaks at work? And I was like, who could be the therapist who would actually do that? And she's like, you know, and so she had this person in her life that she used to imitate that was so funny. And she started to merge these voices. Lisa is so talented anyway.
She's a genius. She's a comedic genius. She can do it all, but she is so unique. Yeah.
The way her brain works is fascinating, and her ability to imitate people is amazing. And then she merges two different real people into a person and creates this character. And so we started to laugh our asses off, imagining the kind of people who thought it was a good idea to get therapy for 3 minutes during lunch, and B, the kind of therapist who thought that that would be a good service. We get approached by Lexis. I mean, this is really before its time. Lexis created a website called L Studio, where they just wanted to create content, not commercials for Lexis, but content that would appeal to the Lexis consumer. And Lisa at the time was driving a Lexus just by coincidence, but they identified Kudrow as like, she is right in the pocket of the Lexis consumer. So whatever Lisa wants to do, let's do. So they gave us a budget. And we asked for complete creative freedom. Like, we can't be turning in drafts, and we want to improvise this, and we want total creative control. And we started making these little webisodes for L Studio, and we asked our friends to be in it. And Jane Lynch was in it, and Stephen Weber was in it, and Courtney Cox was in it. And we would just create the outline of the stories. Who are these clients who, for whatever reason, want a very quick therapeutic fix? And who is this therapist who believes that one day she can take the modality of web therapy and make a bajillion dollars? Like, that's what's driving her. And so we cooked up web therapy, and we would edit it in our office, and we shot it at our office. There's an episode of web therapy in the first season where we turned the garage of the house that was our office was a house in West Hollywood. And we took the garage and we put all the innards of we rented a private plane set, and we put it inside the garage. And Alan Cumming was in a private plane, and we were using teleprompters so that we could see each other and hear each other with an earwig. And that way we could just improvise and be filming on both sides. And I'll never forget, there was a bird sitting on top of the garage door while we were shooting. So through the entire webisode, you hear, and we had to start to talk about it. Like, what? Wow.
Nobody said so.
What's that? It's amazing. You're going so fast, and there's a bird that can, like, we cracked up so many times. But it was the beginnings of making content. And suddenly WME said, you guys have made enough half, like 8 minute episodes, that if you took three of them, you have a half hour comedy that we could sell to a network. And so we pitched it to Bob Greenblatt, who was the head of Showtime. And he said, yeah, why don't we make half hours of web therapy and air them? And pretty soon we were making them not only for the web, because our deal with the actors, this is more than you want to hear, but the deal with the actors was a new media contract. We couldn't afford to make the show and pay everybody full SAG.
Right. Wait, hold on. Was there a SAG new media contract? Or you guys
invented? There had just been a cobbled together, a one-page rider to the SAG contract that was the new media contract. And by the way, we were paying more money than what was the minimum for new media, but we gave every actor, including ourselves, $900 for each episode. And that's all we would ever give, plus residuals, whatever. But everybody got the same amount for half a day's work. And because it was a new media contract, Showtime couldn't own it. Showtime could only license it. And so it was really complicated. We had to air on the web first in order to satisfy that contract. And then we could cobble together the half hours, and it would become a reuse of the content for Showtime. And it was the first time anybody had ever done this.
Yeah, this is the beginnings of the streaming world that we all live in and know, but also the contracts with the actors. I mean, my God, you were on the front lines of when this started.
It was fascinating. Also because we had inadvertently become the studio. Like, we had no studio. So we were just creating the content, delivering it to Showtime. Then we were responsible for reporting it. And then whatever income we got, we had to report to the union and pay the residuals to the actors. And we were acting like a mini studio. And then when Fremantle grabbed the episodes that we finished and sold them internationally, we didn't sell, you know, we didn't make a lot of money, but, you know, for a couple of bucks per episode in Thailand and in Australia, and we played across the world. And it was a really good learning experience because we really got to create that ourselves. And the relationships we had with actors is what allowed us to do the show. We just would call people and say, come on and play.
Ben and I never got that call, but we're not going to hold that against
Christine,
you.
Christine, the actors they have. Yeah.
It's kind of insane. It's kind of insane. That
I know. No. I mean, it's insane with the actor. Like, you guys, with your Rolodexes, so to speak.
Well, the fact that Meryl Streep did it is, to this day.
Like, I was going to say.
I will never forget. I expected her, not for bad reasons, but for just normal business reasons. There was no way she was going to show up to the hotel in New York where we moved production for Meryl for one weekend to shoot her in a hotel in New York.
Because that's what you do for Meryl Streep.
Oh yeah. It costs a fortune. But we're like, everyone's going to New York. We have to find a production designer who will like turn these two hotel rooms into the two sets, which we did. We borrowed people from the good fight, whatever that show was. And and Meryl walked in. She drove herself from her Connecticut home, and she drove herself. We offered her a car. She just drove in, and she was already in hair and makeup. And she was a complete, like, totally team player, laughing her ass off and coming up with great ideas. And it was like one of the highlights of my career. It was just watching her and Lisa
play together. Oh, that's really amazing.
Yeah, you guys, the cast on this show is unreal.
It's crazy.
People must have loved the writing and loved you guys. And it was a prestige, you know, creative project that everyone wanted to show up for you.
The stories were ridiculous. In hindsight, like, the fact that we told some of the stories we told were absolutely ridiculous, but they lend themselves to improv, which is why we did them. And we just let people take it. You know, Julia Louis-Dreyfus comes from improv. So we just let her take her relationship as Fiona's sister wherever she wanted. And, right. You know, and LeBlanc was on it, and Schwimmer was on it, and Matthew Perry was on it. The only, we were trying to get Jennifer to be on it, and she wanted to, but she never could, and the schedule never
allowed. Victor Garber, Rashida Jones, Alan Cummings. I mean, these are some of the greatest people.
Great. Victor was amazing as her gay husband. And it was a highlight. It was just a highlight because people got to play. And by the way, every time we shot someone, we were done in 3 hours. Like, they came on a Saturday morning and they were wrapped by noon.
Yeah, that's just the most fun job, too. When you're going to one of those where it's your friends, you know, you're going to just get to play and just have complete creative freedom. And those are the jobs that, and it doesn't matter if you're getting paid, if you're paying them to fly there to do it, I would do it.
Because it would be so fun. And Don directed every episode. I think I directed two, but Don directed all the others. And he would laugh his ass off. Like, you can hear him laughing in every episode. Right. It's like, Don, stop laughing. We can't get through it. Because you could hear Don in your ear. You can hear your partner, and you can also hear Don pitching lines. He'd be like, oh my God, tell her that you found her cat. Just tell her that you found her cat. You know, Fiona, I found your cat. You know, like, he would just be pitching, and then we'd pitch lines and they'd start laughing, and then Don would start laughing. And, you know, it was just a fun job. We're hoping to, at some point, make a couple more. And Christine, please be on it with Ben.
Oh, stop, stop. With Ben.
Just be on it by yourself. Forget Ben. Ben's going to be busy.
We need to talk because I'm sure we have fans, scan fans, listening here. I being one of them. When you went into Scandal, that, again, I feel like because you have been sort of, you're an actor who works nonstop, but you're also constantly writing, and you've been on writing staffs of huge shows. So you were on Grey's, right? What season of Grey's Anatomy did you go into the Shondaland world?
I was on an episode of Grey's. That was the first time Shonda knew who I was. And then I auditioned for Scandal. I auditioned to play Huck. And it was a great monologue, but I knew I was never going to get it. And then they were like, you know what? You're not Huck, but we're going to find something for you, is what Shonda said to me. Right. And then around the same time that she was about to launch Scandal, my friends Tony and Joan were running Grey's Anatomy, and they asked me to come on as a consulting producer, as a writer. I can't remember if I had already appeared in season one of Scandal. I think
Ella will know. Ella will know all of these timelines.
I think I got asked to play Cyrus's husband by Linda Lowy, who I knew because she had cast me in Under the Tuscan Sun. And she texted me, and I was at my office, and I got a text saying, will you be my husband's husband? And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what game that is. I don't know what that means. But, right. Okay. And so I wound up doing an episode around the time that I was being asked to go on to Grey's Anatomy. And I remember going in for a meeting about writing on Grey's with Shonda and her partner, Betsy, and Tony and Joan. And I walked in and I said, I would love to write on Grey's. I really loved playing this character of, and I don't want to put one against the other, but I'm nervous that if I take this job on Grey's. And she said, we'll know where to find you. You absolutely can write on Grey's, and we'll know where to find you. And so I took a job on Grey's season eight. Mm-hmm. And then throughout season eight, when I was in an episode of Scandal, I would pop out of the writer's room. I'd go shoot for a day or two. I'd come back to the writer's room. And then season nine, I was in the writer's room again on Grey's, and my character became much more popular and more involved in, you know, that story started to explode.
That storyline, right, exactly.
So I was then spending 50% of my time at Grey's and 50% of my time at Scandal and developing another pilot for Shondaland. So I was deeply in the Shondaland world for those 2 years, 2012 to 2014.
And you won yourself an Emmy, my friend. Wow. Was that, just tell us what that amazing. Felt like.
It was,
because I know you so well, and I know that probably never in a million years did you think you were going to win.
No,
No. You probably couldn't even believe getting nominated. No, like
I have to say, getting nominated, I mean, of course it's a thrill to win, but you know it's possible that you could win because you're already part of eight people. Right. You know, it's as if the lottery were played in two sections. You scratch off eight cards and then 100 of you are really close. So then you're like, oh, well, this
there's a chance.
But the fact that I got nominated was like one of the biggest thrills of my entire life to this day. And then, of course, winning was like an outer body experience. I think I was having a nervous breakdown.
On the stage.
That was the craziest thing I've ever experienced. But it was a huge thrill. And, you know, I had been in a very noisy episode of Scandal where Jeff Perry and I had to take off all of our clothes. It was my worst nightmare, to show any skin at all on camera ever. Like the fact that I was horrified, but we had to do it and we did it. And it was a very well written episode. I mean, it was like a short play in the middle of the episode. Just like really, it had a build to it and it was emotional and it was dramatic.
Did you have an intimacy coordinator?
It was before that job. I have to be honest with you. Like I had to do a lot of things on Scandal that made me feel very uncomfortable. And I can see why that job is necessary. Not that anybody meant any harm, but I think they took liberties with me as a gay guy. It was like, well, this is nothing for you. But to have somebody push your head down on camera on an ABC show, it's humiliating in front of a crew. And I was like, oh my God, how many times have women been asked to do shit on it for 50 years on television? And we just take it for granted. Like, this is what women do. It's like,
yeah.
Yes, if that's what was written, but there is a way to talk about doing this so that you don't.
It's you and the other actor that ends up working it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know what the thing is, Jeff was a little older than me, and my character was supposed to be sort of like his younger, hot husband, not hot, but like believably his younger boyfriend, husband. And I think they just wanted my role sexually in his life to just be a certain way, and I found it. It was
cringy
hard.
For you. Hard. Yeah.
It was just hard. And luckily the directors, a good number of Tom Verica was a producer on the show and directed a ton of them. And he was just so respectful and kind about how we did all that stuff. Tony Goldwyn, who was on the show, was also directing a bunch of episodes. And we would have conversations about it. I'm like, why do I have to get on my knees? He's like, do you know how many things I've had to lay on my back in the Oval Office with Carrie on top of me. Right. We're both married.
And I was going to say the Tony, those scenes, talk about
pre-intimacy
coordinators. I mean, Quinn did his high school play and they had an intimacy coordinator for a Tom Stoppard comedy.
Are you joking me?
In a year of, we're in a time where, especially with high school boys and yeah. If there's a girl and a boy in a scene and there's supposed to be a kiss in a high school play and they don't even know what they're doing, she was brought in to make them all feel more comfortable and had be able to advocate for themselves on what their comfort level was. The school was never going to put them in any kind of position. But
of course. But 10 years ago, they did. 10 years ago, you'd be in a school play and you'd do
all kinds of
things that no one even would ask us.
Okay, you two make out.
You're both under the covers and just dry hump, okay? And action. We're going to lose the light. Just do it. And you're like, of course. Yes, of course. And then you go home and you're rocking yourself and you're taking a shower. And you're crying like Glenn Close in
Fatal Attraction.
And they tell it to you right on the day. So you don't have a minute to think about it, right? Like I did a movie for Jack Bender. It took place in the 60s. And he's like, you'd get out of bed. You wouldn't be wearing clothes. So we're just going to shoot you from behind. I was like, okay, I guess I don't have a choice.
Ooh.
I know. This is the thing.
Yeah. And you don't want to make a scene.
No, by the way, everybody was incredibly respectful. It was the set was cleared. Like nobody was disrespectful. I'm just saying it was a different time where people, you know, we just take for granted. You get what you have to get and you talk about it and you talk about it together. David, you said it. It's like you negotiate it with your other actor and together you decide like, are you cool with this? And like, I think we all used to do that for each other for a very long time before someone got it paid to help you do that.
Right. Now it's a new, new gig.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s.
She looked like a million bucks.
With zero qualifications.
She had a Harvard plaque.
Tricks her way past a wall of lawyers and agents.
She's got all of these Maseratis and Bentleys all in the driveway.
Is it like a mansion?
Yes, it's a mansion. That this queen of the con uses to scam some of the biggest names in professional sports out of untold fortunes.
About $6
million? Approximately $11 million.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
Employing whatever means necessary to bleed her victims dry.
She would probably have sex with one of her clients.
Hide your money in your old Richmond, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, this is Paris Hilton. Trapped in Treatment is back, and this season we're taking on WASP.
They held us in dog cages. They starved us. They beat us. They burned us and subject us to really horrible, cruel and unusual punishment.
After my personal experience at Provo Canyon School, I was shocked to learn that a man named Robert Litchfield, a man who got his start at the school that I went to, would go on to create a multi-million dollar empire.
He was trying to brand us, so we were going to become the McDonald's in treatment.
The Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs and Schools.
They prey on, you know, a parent's really natural and beautiful love for their children in a really, really, unfortunately, effective way.
At this time in my life now, if someone presented this program to me, and not just because I've already experienced it, sham, scam, beware.
Listen to Season 2 of Trapped in Treatment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite in powerful conversations. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
I want you all to join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. In every episode, we gather a seasoned elder.
But even with a child, there's no such thing as the wrong thing if you love them.
Myself, as the middle generation, I don't feel like I have to get married at this big age in life, but it is a desire I have and something that I've navigated in dating. And a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations.
I'm very jealous of your generation that didn't have to deal with Instagram and Tinder.
This is Across Generations, where Black women's voices unite, and together, you know how we do, we create magic. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we have to start wrapping up. This went by in like seconds to me.
Seconds.
We haven't even gotten, I mean, there's so many things. You have so many credits, my friend. Well, you have so many things to talk about.
I spent most of my 90s, just to go back for a second, when I went and looked, doing these sort of one-line parts on Party of Five, And then I had a part on this show called Significant Others with Jennifer Garner. And then I had this part on my first job in Hollywood was on The Wonder Years. I played a valet and David Schwimmer. I mean, this is what I think is so funny about talking about careers that have spanned long periods of time. Like, I didn't even know who Schwimmer was, nor did anybody, but he was like the boyfriend on The Wonder Years.
He was great on The Wonder Years. I remember
He was so good. And I was, you know, and they wiped out on the motorcycle on the day that I worked. And so they got hurt and they had to shut down production and we had to reshoot it 3 weeks later. And I remember I got paid again and I couldn't believe it. I can't believe I'm going to get paid again to be the valet, to take someone's ticket and say, I'll be right back, was my line. But the 90s were really all about just like these one line roles, waiter. I played a jewelry clerk 3 times, believe it or not. Don't know why. And a waiter 3 times.
Typecasting.
It's so funny when that happens where you've played something or you play the same character with the same name, like 3 jobs. And I've played Gale. Like, I don't know how many times I'm Gale in certain things.
Dude, I played Josh in Clueless and then on Sabrina back to back.
Yes.
And they had the same trailer at the Paramount lot.
Why wouldn't they just change your name? Change your name.
Amy Heckling didn't know the people at Sabrina. I don't know.
You just seem like a Josh.
You're a Josh. Let's just call you Josh.
It's like the new Karen.
We have to let you go, but I have to end on our moment when you came to stay for the, just because you couldn't write this when you came to, Dan came to stay for the reunion. He had about a half hour I picked him up at the train. He came, he was going to take a quick shower, change clothes, go to the reunion, come back. In between that half hour, the fire department arrived at our house because he set off the smoke detector.
Fire alarm.
It was the shower.
I was taking a shower and I was also hanging up all of my clothes in the shower
to steam
so
it.
So that while I was taking a shower, I was steaming my clothes. And then the steam, when I opened the door, went right into the hallway and off goes the alarm.
All on us because the plate, and it's not, you're not the, I told you, you're not the first person that has happened to. This has happened multiple times. It's where the smoke detector is located. It's right outside of the shower.
Mortified.
So
I was mortified.
We've had it all changed. I hope it didn't scare you away.
When you're staying at someone else's house, you just don't want to.
It happened to me twice in my life and always with the biggest stars in the world. So I'm staying with Christine Taylor and Ben.
You don't have to throw me in there as the
I'm staying with Christine Taylor and Ben Stiller, and I completely call the fire department. And then about 10 years earlier, I was staying at Gwyneth Paltrow's London flat, and I set the bedroom on fire.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm like, I should not be allowed to stay in anyone's home, whether they're famous or not.
This is a thing for you.
This is a thing.
That's a nice. I like you.
Do you remember Ben's scene in Along Came Polly where he's at her house?
Oh,
and
we
clogs
just,
the
we,
toilet. That is my biggest nightmare. If that ever happened,
watched that scene. We just showed that movie to Quinn and rewatched it. I hadn't seen it in years, and Quinn turned to me. I was laughing. I mean, tears, sobbing, because it's not only is it, it's Ben's worst nightmare. And it's Ben's worst nightmare seeing himself on screen
fix it with the towel.
I was like, why would he choose to use a hand towel to flush it down the
toilet? It's perfect. The level of panic of what one does in that situation is so not smart.
Right.
You're like, I think the fire...
I called you. I was like, I think the fire department's coming. And then in walks, you know, 3 hunky firemen. And I was like, oh, this is so embarrassing. I just wanted to come and go and not be noticed.
I know. It didn't work. And you made your mark. And we are going to do it again.
Yeah.
Fireman free.
Fireman free. It was heaven. Thank you for letting me do that. Thank you. Because I was noticed at your house, but I was not noticed at my reunion. So it wound up being a really useful weekend.
It made you feel good.
Oh my God.
I love you. Thank you for doing this. This was so fun.
Me.
So
David,
fun.
What a delight. You guys, this is so fun.
So great to meet you, man. I'm literally crying. I'm wiping tears. This is so fun.
Well.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
I love you.
Okay.
Thanks,
bye.
Thank you. Bye.
I'm literally crying from laughter. That is so funny. The fire department shows up while he's staying.
And it was so clear because I tried to call them off, but once it's called in, you can't illegally. They can't. They have to come. And I waited for them, and I said, "Do you really have to go over there? Because I have a house guest who's about to go out to his reunion, and he's like getting changed. You really have to go in and check." He said, "Well, we'd feel better about it."
Okay. I'll go over with you. But he won't. Okay.
Anyway, that was great.
He's so funny. Oh my God.
He is so talented and just the greatest. He's really my bestie. He's my bestie. I just love him.
I was so happy to talk to him. And honestly, the way they did web therapy.
Fascinating, is so, right?
They were like pioneers.
Yeah.
Like to get Lisa Kudrow to do a web show. I mean, that was unheard of in 2008, you know?
Yeah. It was what Dan said too. They really were so ahead of their time. And even we didn't even get to some of the, they produce game shows together, like really cool, fun game shows that they started to like. They've been so prolific in their work together. And I know they're no longer producing partners, but they're like best of friends and really, really awesome. So thanks to Dan for coming on. And thanks to all of our listeners for, coming back. We'll be back next week.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great week.
Thanks for listening. Make sure to subscribe and give us 5 stars.
And please follow us on Instagram at Hey Dude, the 90s called. See you next time.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s.
She looked like $1 million.
Scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, this is Paris Hilton. Trapped in Treatment is back, and this season we're taking on WASP, the Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs and Schools.
They held us in dog cages. They starved us. They beat us.
He was trying to brand us, so we were going to become the McDonald's of kid treatment.
Join my host as they unravel the story of the largest and most shocking organization in the history of the troubled teen industry. Listen to Season 2 of Trapped in Treatment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late-night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.